Today's Taisho is on case 30 in the Mumonkan, the Wu Menkuan, Matsu's This Very Mind is Buddha, or Basso's This Very Mind is Buddha. Dai Bai asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso answered, "This very mind is the Buddha." Wu Men's commentary. If you directly grasp Basso's meaning, you wear the Buddha's clothes, eat the Buddha's food, speak the Buddha's words, do the Buddha's deeds. That is, you are the Buddha himself. However, alas, Dai Bai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the balance for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? If a man of understanding hears anyone say, "This is the very mind of Buddha," he will cover his ears and rush away. Wu Man's verse, "The blue sky and bright day, no more searching around. What is Buddha?" you ask. "With loot in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent." It's a beautiful spring day, I think, outside. And it's even more beautiful in here because people have come here this morning with all the hundreds and hundreds of things that could be done to practice the way of the Buddhas. And nothing could be more wonderful to me than that. I really thank you for coming. This practice is, this path, I should say, is really wonderful beyond compare. I must say that every sit is a good sit, but some sits are really good sits. Today I must be honest, I was having just a wonderful sit. It's not really paradise. The practice of Zen is precious beyond any power that anybody has to describe in words. I must say that I am so grateful for this path. It's just wonderful, really incomparable experience. Doing meditation is really wonderful. And I'm just very grateful. I think there are some things that you can do a couple times and you've pretty much done them, you know? When I was growing up, my great dream when I was about 16 was to drive a car. I thought driving a car would set me free. And I was eager to drive a car. My parents knew that I was an incredible klutz. I was very clumsy. And it must be interesting to be a parent and have a child who's very clumsy. You know, you love them, but then they do things like hit themselves in the head with a hammer, and you must love them all the more, you know. So I was not very coordinated, and I don't have very good motor skills. So basically, my parents sort of made me go to driver's education. And my mother took me out in the parking lot near our house and just made me drive around for hours. It was so boring, but she just wanted to make sure I wasn't going to kill myself immediately. And I was so eager to get the car. I was indeed a terrible driver. My sister and brother wouldn't even ride with me in the car. My sister would just be on the edge of her seat the whole time. And I was doing my best, but I was a very poor driver. And at any rate, when I got finally my driver's license, I thought it would transform my life. But, you know, after driving for a couple of years, you know, I realized that driving is the most boring thing in the world, you know. You get in the car, and it's always the same. and there's nothing, there's no increase in its excitement. Now, you know, if you're driving along a country road or something, the road is beautiful, you know. But for me, driving is not one of these experiences that gains as you do it over and over. Sometimes, though, there are things you do in life that the more you do them, the more wonderful they become. And I would say that Zazen is number one for me. And I think it will be number one for you. Every time I sit, honestly and truly, I mean this with my whole heart, it's fascinating. And my whole body comes to life. And I feel this life energy pouring through my body. Sometimes it's like an explosion. It's like a bomb going off. It's so wonderful. And it's not always like a bomb going off, but sometimes it is. It's just so wonderful. And even when it's okay, it's wonderful. It's I feel like every atom in my body has been cleansed, and like I'm plugged into the universe. It's just an incredible feeling. So I highly recommend meditation. I promise you with my whole heart that if you walk this path, it will not let you down. There are many things in life that turn out to be anti-climax. For example, I was working very hard to get my PhD. You know, I'm not a very good student, actually. I got into graduate school because I wanted to study Zen with Genki Roshi and Webb. And graduate school was like a respectable thing to do while I was doing Zen practice. So I took it seriously, but I wasn't that talented. But I did dream of getting my PhD, and the day I got my PhD, it was a funny thing, you know. I got my PhD and I didn't feel any different. You know, just no real change, just symbolic change. But I think Zen practice is real change. And you can get your PhD and say, well, you know, what was that all about? That wasn't so great, or that was okay, or you can, maybe you're happy, that's good. But 100% guarantee that if you walk the path of Zen, you will not be disappointed at the end of that path, and you will not be let down. It's a 100% certainty. Everybody I know who sticks with this path has a really marvelous life. I know quite a few people, actually, who have gone through Zen training. And they all really have this wonderful attitude, this wonderful outlook, and these amazing experiences on the cushion and off the cushion. After a while, you know, it's like this when you're off the cushion, too. So, you know, if you want to be plugged into the universe, if you want to have life energy pouring through your body when you would like, all you have to do is practice Zazen for a while, and it will happen. Now, if you read the Buddhist sutras, it doesn't say some people will get it and some people won't, you know. It doesn't say it's a matter of talent or aptitude or IQ, or there's no BQ, Buddhist quotient, you know, there's no BQ rating. You do it, you will be liberated. And liberation is not just negative, like free from suffering. It's a paradise, truly paradise. Even when I sleep, I do sometimes have dreams. I don't always have dreams, but sometimes I do have dreams. And the other night, I had a dream and I was with Webb, my teacher, and we were doing Zazen together, and I was in this state, you know, this wonderful state. And when I woke up, I was still in that state. And that's very common for people who do this. So please believe me when I tell you, you won't be disappointed. People who go this route usually say at the end of it, what I would say too, I don't deserve this. I really don't deserve to be this happy. I haven't done anything in my rather mediocre life that deserves this happiness. And so it's an undeserved gift. And a little zazen is all you have to do. Little pain in the legs, little pain in the back, little difficulty, but a small price to pay. So today is the koan is Daibai asked Basso, "What is Buddha?" And Basso answered, "This very mind is Buddha." Now this is an interesting koan. Usually people get involved in Zen because they realize that ordinary mind is not Buddha. You know, people begin to notice that they are unhappy. This is actually mental health. People who live in what we call samsara, or ordinary reality, and are happy are in really difficult situation. For example, people who really like lots of money and enjoy inflicting pain on other people, and who are selfish and self-absorbed, usually don't come into zendos. Generally speaking, those people don't come into the zendo. People who come into zendos generally are people who have maybe had an experience that was difficult or painful, or they have been disappointed in some way, or they have just become aware that something about everyday reality is not very satisfactory. And those people are rather sensitive and observant people, I think. Generally, the people who are interested in pushing other people around and so on, they generally are so absorbed in samsara that they don't realize that it is a very unhappy place. Or they're unhappy themselves, but they don't allow themselves to see it. Somehow, through good fortune, people sort of lose confidence in everyday reality. You know, a lot of people have a suspicion that everyday reality is not A-OK. They suspect that the order of things is defective, but they hope it's going to work out. It's like the lottery, you know. A lot of people lose the lottery. One person wins, but everybody who plays the lottery hopes it's going to work out. Generally, people know that probably many things in life are not fair, and that life is very risky proposition. If you're a statistician, you know that if you just get in your car and you drive down the road, there's a certain chance that you might get hit and killed. It's, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, what the odds are, but it's possible. So, you know, that's a precarious aspect of life. We generally, just to function, have to say, well, I'm pretty sure I won't be one of the unlucky ones today, so I'll get in my car and drive. But the truth is, you know, sometimes things happen to us and we go, gee, you know, this is not such a great thing, this ordinary reality. Maybe we feel it's a little empty. Maybe we feel it encourages people to behave less than 100%. Maybe it has encouraged us to behave less than 100% as good people. So whatever brings you to the cushion is a great luck, really great luck, and you should feel a great gratitude just to have come to the cushion. I'm always amazed by people who start sitting and stop. To me, that's a real puzzle. I wish I knew how to deal with that, maybe to encourage people more or to keep them practicing. Because generally, if this is your path, you know, when you find this path, you generally stick with it. I think at least when I started sitting, this cushion was really the place to be, I thought. I really liked Zazen was really hard for me. I had a lot of problems when I started practicing. My legs hurt me quite a bit, and my posture was really terrible. Even today, my posture isn't very good, but back then, it was really, like, awful. And it was always just a struggle to sit. Even for half an hour at first, I would be covered with sweat in the summer. And had a lot of stress when I first sat. I would actually feel stressed. But something kept at it. Something kept me going. And I just think it was that when I would sit, I felt this freedom. I felt this real something inside me, this life, coming to life. Hard to explain, but I think if you're that kind of person, coming to the cushion is a great gift. So, you know, usually people who practice Zen understand that ordinary mind is not Buddha. It's very confused. You know, most people are either very frightened or they're nervously trying to manipulate the world. This is just the way everybody is. You know, basically, I was reading the other day that that in any organization, 80% of the people do 20% of the work, and 20% of the people do 80% of the work. That's interesting, isn't it? In other words, if you look at an English department, 20% of the people in the English department do 80% of the work. I think that's really interesting. And, you know, that means most people are only doing a little bit of work. So, you know, basically, why are they doing a little bit of work? I think maybe they've gotten discouraged. You know, a lot of people get discouraged, they become fearful, they don't feel that they can make a contribution. Maybe they have low self-esteem. I know that in English there's a lot of people who are like, you know, they were very good scholars maybe 20 years ago, but the kind of work they do has gone out of style. So they feel kind of useless, and they're sort of a little bit unhappy. This is very common. You know, my father was in the military, and he never made the rank he wanted to make. He wanted to be at a certain rank, and he never got there. He was always embarrassed about himself, you know. And so, you know, fear and I think some degree of shame were always part of his everyday experience. And I think that's very typical of humans. You know, basically, we're always a little bit afraid, a little bit fearful or ashamed. Or, you know, we're striving to manipulate the world in ways we want. And this is sort of like everyday reality. You know, we have to try to adjust the world to fit, you know, our plans. We're human beings. That's what we do. We don't, you know, we aren't hunters and gatherers. We don't just count on luck. We plan. So, but, you know, that way of living creates a certain limitation inside of ourselves. You know, little by little, fear makes us not trust life so much. So, you know, when we come to the cushion, I think we've begun to feel unhappy with not trusting life. Begun to feel that this is not such a good way to live, always afraid or always trying to manipulate things. So we know, in a certain sense, that everyday mind is really screwed up. You know, ordinary mind is really screwed up. A lot of people have compulsive behaviors. You know, they get mad and they don't know why they get mad. Or they're depressed. A lot of depression is quite a big problem in the United States. I always think it's interesting that we have a society that does so much to amuse people and to make them happy, but in fact, the depression is very widespread. You know, and this is also like ordinary mind, these mental habits that are very crippling or unsatisfactory, can be very extreme. You know, I sit with a little group up in northern New Jersey on Sunday morning, and a number of the people in that group are substance abusers. And they have real problems when they sit because their mental habits are so messed up, basically. I think I mentioned this last time, but there's a person in our group, and every time he sits on the cushion, he's in real hell mentally. You know, all of these angry voices inside himself, all of these, he's not, you know, insane. He just has a turmoil of emotions inside himself. And I always say after the sit, "How did your sit go?" And he always goes, "Boy, it was rough. It was rough." This is an ordinary mind, you know, ordinary mind. Not to Buddha, it would seem. You know, this is a strange koan. What is Buddha? Ordinary mind is Buddha. Ordinary mind is Buddha. This very mind is Buddha. How can this be? This very mind is very screwed up. So Zen practice begins with a kind of dissatisfaction about ordinary mind, which really can't be trusted. I'm convinced that most people go around in a kind of fantasy world all day long. I mean, ask yourself this question: how often am I in the present moment? And how often am I in a fantasy state? Either imagining something might be happening or imagining myself in some other place. I don't know, maybe you're different, but when I was in high school and in much of my time in college, when I was sitting in class, I was really in Hawaii or someplace in my mind. You know, yeah? Does that sound familiar? You know, the person would be talking and I would be hearing, but in my mind, you know, I was doing something very different. And, you know, this goes on all the time. I mean, you have to go see some friends, and maybe in your head you tell a little story. You see yourself going through the room, greeting them, shaking their hands or whatever. Hey, hey guy, you know, and everybody's going to pat you on the back and so on. And, you know, so you have like a little mental script. You enter the room, and you're not really in the room. You're in your mind, and you're a little bit in the room. And then, you know, maybe the things don't go the way you plan, and you can react in various ways. You know, you get upset. It's like, you know, oh man, I thought this was going to be a good party, and now everybody's, you know, coming and they're, you know, fighting with each other, and, you know, what a horrible experience, you know. And so it didn't fit the story, you know. So some people get really mad if things don't fit their mental stories. And some people get discouraged, you know, they get depressed because they imagine things one way and then they don't turn out that way. We all do this all the time. We have like, you can ask yourself, how often am I in the moment, really and truly, without interpretation or any attempt to manipulate, just present in the moment? And how often am I locked in my own head? You know, in dreams, projections, or sometimes just powerful fears and emotions. Very seldom, really, are people present in the moment. This is, I think, astonishing. You know, really and truly, if you begin to look at humans carefully, you see how rare it is for somebody to be awake, to be really and truly just present with things as they are. And in fact, you know, many people think things as they are, that's dead and lifeless. You know, if you just say, there are some people, you know, if you say, I just want to see the world as it is, without any interpretation, any emotional overlay, they would go, oh, why would you want to do that? It's just dead matter, you know, just matter. And their idea is that we have to bring to the world something to make it meaningful. We saturate it with our hopes and dreams, and then it has meaning, but in itself it's just meaningless. This is a very common Western way of thinking about the world. This is a basic, you know, by Western I mean like Europe and the United States. This is the way people in the West think about the world, that the world is in itself just matter, and that we give it meaning through our imagination or our willpower or creativity. And then if we stop doing this, it's all going to go dead on us. This is a very common way of thinking. I think most modern people, even in the Asian world, think this way. So, you know, this is a very frightened mindset, very fearful mindset. You know, I myself used to just tell these little stories to myself because life seemed so boring. You know, I don't know about you, but high school for me was like unbelievably boring. And I would just, I had an algebra professor who had all the class lessons on these rolls of cellophane. You know, they're like, this is an overhead projector. And this poor man had put his whole lessons for the whole year on these rolls of plastic. And he'd roll them across the projector and they'd project on the screen. And he'd just take us through. He used the same rolls for, you know, for like, I don't know, 20 years. So you can imagine how much energy he brought, and you know, how exciting this became. It was unbelievably boring. He'd take us through, he'd take the pointer, he'd put it on and go, you know, this times this is this, and this is this. Any questions? And then he'd roll to the next one. You know, any questions? So naturally, you know, you're sitting in class and you're thinking, you know, whatever, you'd like to be Ferris Bueller or something like that in a movie character. Or, and maybe if you read a lot of novels, you're fighting pirates or something like that in your head. I like to read novels. So, you know, I was in Greece or I was, you know, adventurer doing something in my head. And not paying attention to my algebra too. This is so common. You know. So we're terrified, really, that if we just see things as they are, everything's going to go collapsing around us. Very interesting. There's a play by you may know this playwright Eugene O'Neill, but he has a play called The Iceman Cometh, and it's about a bunch of people who hang out in a bar. And basically, they all tell stories all day. You know, they're all people who are dysfunctional, and they sit around and they go, yeah, I've got a big deal coming through. When it comes through, I'm going to make some money, you know. But all of this is just baloney. It's all just stories they tell to amuse themselves. So the main character, I think his name is Hickey, he decides he comes into the bar and he stops drinking. And he comes into the bar and he says, let me tell you something. You guys are full of baloney. You don't have any deals. You don't have any plans. You're just a bunch of bums in a bar. And you know what? It's horrifying to them. They realize their lives are totally meaningless. And so, you know, basically, they have to go back to telling these stories to stay sane. Well, this is a very dark view of reality, but it's the average person's view, I think. You know, the truth is that reality is wonderful beyond our wildest dreams. This moment, I mean, I wish I could convey to you my sit this morning, but this moment is beyond anybody's wildest dreams. It's so wonderful and so beautiful and so alive. It's amazing. I get up and do zazen every day. You know, 2 hours or more, I sit in the evening with our group. It's just heaven. And I just look around and think, God, if only people could see how great this is. It's just, it's such a darn shame. Really, and it's not at all like Eugene O'Neill, even though he's a great playwright. He's got it 100% wrong. Reality is really fantastic. Unfortunately, humans don't ever live in reality. They ordinarily live in fantasy. In fact, they create whole fantasy worlds to amuse themselves. But it doesn't really work. It makes them depressed or it makes them unhappy. So what we might call ordinary mind, we mean by that fear and desire and projections and fantasies. Well, that isn't Buddha. Absolutely 100% not Buddha. But, you know, if you begin to walk the path of Zen, you begin to change your mental habits. Because all of this is just about mental habits, culture, mental habit, personal experience. You know, at first, it's difficult. You know, you sit on the cushion, and usually there's an athletic dimension to Zen practice. I mean, you have to kind of be an athlete. You have to accustom your body to sitting on the cushion for rather long periods of time. And it's just like running. You know, if you run the first time you go jogging, you know, if you do half a mile, you're ready to take a nap, you know. If you do too much, you have injury. But, you know, if you jog every other day for 10 years, you can jog for 7 miles and you hardly break into a sweat, you know. So this is very much like that. You have to sort of accustom your body to sitting. And believe it or not, this posture that we sit in is really excellent for long periods of focused attention. At first, you know, this lotus posture or the half lotus or the Burmese posture seem crazy. This is crazy. I was asked by Livingston College to give a demonstration to some students who were in a program from high school. There were 50 students, and I talked about Zen, and they were all totally interested. And then I said, okay, well, let me show you how we do it. And I got in put my cushion on the middle of the room and put my other cushion on it, sat down, pulled my legs up, and I'm telling you, they went wild. Those kids almost didn't know what to do. They thought this was the weirdest thing they had ever seen. And I lost them at that moment. I never got that audience back, you know. Because they just, this was like, if I had put my foot up my nose, it would have been just as weird, you know. That was just unbelievable to them. So that was not a success that time. So you can think, this is crazy sitting like this. But, you know, this way of sitting goes way back, you know, in ancient India. Really, like 3,000 years ago, people were sitting this way. And the people who invented yoga were interested in transforming consciousness. They realized that, you know, consciousness can take many different forms. You know, if it's a sunny day and you're depressed, when you go outside, the sun seems oppressive, right? If you're depressed, you go outside, the sun seems, like this thing beating down on you. On the other hand, if you're happy and you go outside and it's sunny, it feels wonderful. It's like, oh, I love the sun. It's really not the sun. It's your mental state, you know. This is something people have often overlooked. You know, the sun is neither happy nor not happy. It's our mental state, you know. Actually, cloudy day makes me very happy. I love rain and cloud. I come into my office when it's raining and my secretaries are, oh no, another rainy day. And I'm just, I'm just bouncing around. I wonder, gee, why are they so down? And I realize I'm happy because the rain is pitter-pattering. And the rain is neither happy nor unhappy. It's how we approach, it's our mental state. So, you know, these people in ancient India realized that a mental state was flexible. The human mind is flexible. It's not locked in. We can, how we experience the world is a product of our mental habits, and they can be changed. So they started fooling around with body positions, and they realized if you've seen these people doing yoga standing on their head and things like this, they began to experiment. And this posture, the lotus posture, is the one they discovered allows for the greatest level of energy and also the high level of concentration for the longest period of time. People who have been doing this for a long time can sit for 2 or 3 hours without any trouble. And you really couldn't do that even in a chair. You'd begin to go crazy if you were sitting even in a comfortable chair. There's something about this posture that's very, very magical. Also, just about the same time in China, ancient Taoist masters were experimenting with breath, the breath, and with the qi energy. And they made many interesting discoveries about how the breath affects the flow of energy in the body and how the flow of energy affects consciousness. And Zen, or Chan, is the fusion of ancient Indian meditative practices and ancient Taoist meditative practices. So this body posture that seems so weird is really quite miraculous. Especially if you eventually try full lotus. It takes a couple years, but I think you'll suddenly notice that your sit is really transformed by full lotus posture. Many people who sit full lotus at first have a physical pain, discomfort. But they don't usually go back because they realize their minds are so much sharper and their energy level is so much higher. Very interesting. You want to take it slow. You don't want to strain your muscles. And if you feel very, very confined when you sit full lotus, it's not a good thing. You want to, you know, build up Burmese for a while, then quarter lotus, then half lotus, and work with your breath, build a good foundation. But this athletic dimension is part of the system, part of the game. Then, basically you want to watch your breath until you can enter what's called samadhi. And samadhi is also very ancient mental state. Basically, in samadhi, the sense of self disappears and you feel unified with the world around you. You may have had this experience. Sometimes people go into samadhi naturally. For example, if you like the woods, if you like to go out in the forest, when I was backpacking, I used to do a lot of backpacking, and sometimes I would walk into a forest, like I'd come from my job and I'd leave on a Friday night and go up to hike in the Olympic Mountains. And as soon as I would enter the forest, it was like myself just totally disappeared. It was really like this, suddenly this being inside the forest, and the forest inside me, and the self-consciousness just disappears. It's like natural samadhi. You know, if you see something very beautiful, sometimes you just feel connected. It's like, what is this feeling, you know? So that's natural samadhi. If you like to jog or run, you just forget about your thoughts, you forget about everything, you're just pure, you know, you just run. You can feel like you're running like the wind. That's just samadhi. So, usually takes maybe a year or so to enter deep samadhi by watching the breath. When you can enter deep samadhi, you're unified with the world around you and the self disappears to some degree. This is a foundation of Zen practice. Some people, if you read books on Zen, you will sometimes hear people say that Zen does not cultivate samadhi. There are people who say Zen does not require you to enter samadhi. I have seen that in various books on Zen, but in fact, my teacher, his teacher, and teachers all the way back to Buddha in our lineage say, first you have to enter samadhi, this state of stabilized, impersonal, unified awareness. Then you go on to more advanced states. But you may read in some books that Zen does not believe in samadhi, but this is actually not so. Samadhi is very important. In the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara Guanyin is doing samadhi and answers the question. When we recite our sutra, the Heart Sutra, the answer is the Bodhisattva's answer to a question, and it says the Bodhisattva was in deep samadhi. In all of the sutras, when the Buddha speaks, he always says he entered samadhi. And then he spoke. The confusion over this issue of samadhi is because in Zen practice we don't stay in ordinary samadhi. For example, when you enter samadhi, it's often very, very, very pleasant. What happens is your sense of self disappears. You feel like a rock, very fixed. You may feel like you have no weight. You may feel that there's no time. But generally, it's a very pleasant, luminous condition. It's very pleasant. In samadhi, the self disappears. You're just present, unified with the moment. And often there's very little thinking. And that's a very pleasant state. But we don't stay in that condition. In other words, you must learn how to enter samadhi, but we don't stay in samadhi. We practice wuxin, we practice mu. And actually, mu is deeper even than samadhi, because mu is this blankness that your mind confronts. See, samadhi is just one particular state. It's possible to become very attached to samadhi, but you can enter samadhi and leave samadhi. Now see, so it's not enlightenment. The early Hindus thought samadhi was enlightenment. They thought that when they entered this wonderful realm of no self and absorption into the world, they were liberated. But the Buddha said, no, this is not a full enlightenment. It's just one state. So then we practice what is called wuxin, no mind. The no mind doesn't even dwell in samadhi. It goes even deeper, and it enters a state that is completely formless. This is the Zen way, not to dwell in any particular state, but to practice wuxin. And in wuxin, when we enter this state, which is like the whole world disappears as well as the self, everything disappears. No self, no world. Body and world drop away, we say. In this state, we begin to practice with our koans. So the koan may be something like this one, ordinary mind. This very mind is Buddha. So you enter wuxin, this blank state that's even deeper than samadhi, and you say, this very mind, this very mind, this very mind. And this koan sinks down into your deep unconscious. And usually nothing happens at first. If you're working with a koan, initially it's very hard to embrace it. It just seems like an empty phrase or an empty question, empty fact. So if your koan is that this very mind is Buddha, you might be saying with each breath, this mind, this mind, this mind, this mind. And for a long time, nothing happens. It just seems empty or lifeless. But what eventually happens is that the koan begins to grip you. It begins to engage your whole attention, body and soul, you could say. This is called, in Zen, this is called great doubt. There are three pillars of Zen: great faith, great determination. If you want to walk the path of Zen, you have to believe in the path. You have to have determination. And finally, you have to cultivate great doubt. That means that when you're working with your koan, you become uncertain. You say, this mind, this mind, this mind, this mind. And it becomes more and more uncertain, more and more uncertain for you. See, when you think you know it, you're far from the koan. when it becomes very uncertain, then you're entering the koan deeply, and it grips you. It becomes like an obsession. You can't put it down. You've got to know. And this is called the great doubt. And it forms what we say is a great mass of doubt inside you. When people are doing the mu koan, this great mass of doubt explodes. It actually explodes. It's so powerful. So you enter Ushin and you say your koan, and it begins to build up like a pressure inside yourself as a great doubt grows. And this pressure, this really happens. You know, when you're working with a koan, at first the teacher gives you the koan and you're sitting and everything is wonderful. And you think, well, this is no problem. This is going to be very easy. I can answer this. But then what happens is you begin to realize, this koan is very sticky, very difficult. It sticks. I can't get free. I can't just keep dancing around this koan. I have to, this is troubling me. This is troubling me. What does this mean? This mind. Which mind? Which mind? How can my mind be Buddha? I'm unhappy. I'm screwed up. My legs are hurting. How can that be Buddha? See? So you go deeper and deeper. This doubt, it's not like a... It's uncertainty is a better word. Great uncertainty. Great uncertainty. This builds up inside you until you... There's a lot of pressure. It's like pressure builds up. And then, pow! Something happens. Out of your deep, deep, deep mind, true mind, some answer comes. And it can be an action, depending on the koan. It can be an action. It can be a statement. It can be something else. Different koans have different answers. But you may see something. You may hear something with your inner eye. Basically, the answer comes to you by paying attention, by looking inward with your inner eye, you could say. The people are caught up in the forms that come out of the deep mind, and they don't look at the mind itself. So in Zen, we look at the mind itself. We turn away from form and we go into Ushin, no state at all. You could say Ushin is either special kind of samadhi, the samadhi of shunyata, or beyond samadhi. Either way is true. We enter this state of blankness, which is actually not blank. It only feels blank. And then the koan, we take the koan into our heart, and it builds up pressure. And then inside ourselves, psychologically, it's like a moment of transformation, and enlightened mind comes out just for a second. It's like a door opens inside yourself, and for a minute, just for a flash, enlightened mind, and then it closes up again. So next koan opens up a little bit, closes. Next koan opens up a little bit, closes. Each koan opens up to enlightened mind just a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Each time there's an opening. Opening. And at first, the student doesn't even know, doesn't feel like anything. Sometimes I would go in to see my teacher and I'd give him my answer and he would just say, fine, that's fine. And I would think, well, how do I know? I had no idea why he passed me. Sometimes I would think he just did it out of pity. And maybe that's true. Now I think maybe that's true. But, probably I had stumbled across the answer, but your discriminating mind generally doesn't know. It's a deeper part of yourself. So, basically if you answer, you start working with these koans, you're really not looking for an answer, you're looking for an opening into your true mind, your true nature. And it's like a little opening, and then it closes, then it opens, then it closes, koan after koan. Somewhere along this process, people have a great opening. It's called the great Kensho, we say, is a great enlightenment experience, big enlightenment, or the opening is open and it's permanently opened. And it's quite dramatic. People cry for days, they laugh for days, pretty amazing. After that, it is true, this very mind is Buddha. This very mind is Buddha. Yes, after that, this very mind is Buddha. Actually, once you've had your Dai Kensho, your great Kensho, there's still a little work to be done. A little more practice has to take place. But little by little, every moment is awakened mind. Every moment becomes awakened mind. And this is real liberation. No matter what state you're in Buddha mind. See, this is... in other words, look, you know, one day you're going to be on a wonderful vacation and you'll sit on your cushion maybe in the morning and you look at the Pacific Ocean and you do Zazen and you enter enlightened mind. This is, if you practice long enough, this will happen to you. Wonderful. But also one day you're going to be lying in a hospital bed and you're going to have a bunch of tubes into your chest and you'll be an old man or an old woman and you'll be in agony. And then too, you will have the ability to be in enlightened mind. So that day is coming if you practice with a complete heart. Absolutely uninterrupted paradise. Mumon's verse, blue sky and bright day, that's a fundamental mind. Real everyday mind, real this very mind, is blue sky and bright day always. No more searching around. What is Buddha, you ask? It's right there. It's right there. With loot in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent. What people discover when they go through this process is that enlightened mind was there all along. And it's very interesting. People who have Dai Kensho say, I didn't realize, but it's been there all along. I just didn't pay attention. Very interesting. So, I look forward to the day when you have that experience yourself. I hope I'm there. So, this was our Saturday sit. I look forward to our next Saturday together.